This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Just a few weeks ago, the Mexican government agreed to hand the notorious drug kingpin El Chapo, Joaquin Guzman Loera, over to the United States. Chapo is as notorious for his prison record as he was for his crimes. He was imprisoned and escaped, captured, escaped again, through a tunnel dug by his henchmen right into the prison. Just a gigantic embarrassment for the Mexican government. And he was recaptured earlier this year. Now, one of the reasons the American government wants El Chapo to stand trial here is that U.S. attorneys have a couple of star witnesses to testify against him. They're Americans, former drug dealers who work for the Sinaloa cartel and then became federal informants. Patrick Radden Keefe has covered the drug war for years. Patrick, who are these guys?
So they're a pair of identical twins from Chicago, Pedro and Margarito Flores. They're Mexican-American. They're born in the U.S. and actually grew up on the West Side. It's funny, you know, I've been writing about the drug trade for years, but there's this one aspect of the business that always remained kind of stubbornly mysterious to me. We all know about these big drug cartels in Mexico, and we know they import huge amounts of cocaine, heroin, marijuana, methamphetamine to the United States. And we're also probably familiar with the idea that there's a retail drug market here where people buy these drugs. But the one thing I've always been curious about is where do those two worlds intersect? Where do they meet? Who are the middlemen who actually negotiate with the big suppliers who deal in kilos in Mexico and the street corner dealers who deal in grams here in the United States?
And these guys are the middlemen in some way?
Yes. So they actually grew up in a family where their father, who was an immigrant from Mexico, had dabbled in the drug trade himself. But by their early 20s, they'd really gone into the business in a big way. And what they were wholesalers. They would negotiate directly with Mexican cartels to buy just enormous volumes of drugs.
What kind of volume, what kind of money are we talking about?
Literally tons of drugs. They imported tons and tons of cocaine to the United States, but also dealing in heroin and marijuana.
And why were they so successful?
Well, there are a few things that are required in order to do this. You need the kind of comfort level with people on both sides of the border. You need to be able to interact with people in Mexico, but also people here. The other thing you need to be able to do, which is really interesting, is buy these drugs on consignment, on credit, because nobody puts down cash on the barrel for that volume of narcotics.
No kidding. That's the way you buy drugs, is on consignment?
All based on trust.
What kind of trust can there be in that world?
Oh, there's a great deal of trust when unwritten contracts are enforceable with death. Part of what made them so successful is there's a great deal of betrayal in the underworld. But these guys were twins. They were brothers. They were incredibly close. They could finish each other's sentences. And so this allowed them to really be a unit, and they would never double-cross one another. Margarito was kind of more outgoing. He was sort of the relationships guy. Pedro was the logistics manager. But they worked very closely together, and they could kind of communicate in shorthand. The trust between them was unshakable.
So what you had is you had the front guy, the people guy, and the systems guy.
Absolutely, like in a business.
That's amazing.
And the other thing about them that distinguished them was that they weren't violent. They were never violent. You remember that line from the famous line from The Godfather about how violence is bad for business. They really internalized this to a kind of astonishing degree.
Wait. They were basically drug lords, and yet they were of the nonviolent variety?
Yeah. Working for very violent organizations, buying their drugs. I'll give you an example. So at a certain point, one of the twins is actually kidnapped. Pedro is kidnapped by a rival in Chicago and held for ransom. And Margarito just pays a ransom of over $1 million to get him released. They had a rough idea of who it was who had done this, but did they go out and seek revenge? No. Would have been bad for business. They just accepted the loss and kept moving. So I'd always heard about the Flores twins, but I'd never really known a great deal about them. And then just recently, a guy named Tom Shakeshaft, who was a federal prosecutor in Chicago who had brought some really major cases against the Sinaloa drug cartel, retired, and he agreed to come in and talk with me about the Flores twins. And he told me that they were really just kids. They were born in 1981, at the height of their power. They were still in their mid-20s, yet they became a kind of indispensable bottleneck.
Flores brothers were moving so much quantity of drugs and were making enough money that customers needed them worse than they needed any particular customer. And so they would just cut them off.
The twins were thriving in Chicago, but eventually they got indicted in the U.S. And here's where their cultural fluency on both sides of the border really helped them. What they did is they just moved to Mexico and relocated their operations and started essentially running their Chicago business remotely from down in Mexico. And that worked out pretty well until 2008, when their main supplier, the Sinaloa cartel, began to fracture.
The Sinaloa cartel was part of what been referred to as the Federation, which included a number of cartel leaders who were working together. And that at some point, there was a split within the Federation. Well, the Flores brothers were being supplied by two different cartels within the Federation. And when those two different cartels went to war with one another, the Flores brothers were put in a very tenuous position of getting an ultimatum from each side that the Flores brothers were to work only with that side or else.
But this really sounds like The Godfather, doesn't it, Patrick? I mean, you have a split in what's called the Federation, and the brothers have to decide what to do. Who do they go with?
Exactly. It was an impossible situation. It turns out, however, there was a third option. They let it be known through a lawyer who was working for them that they might be willing to cut a deal with the U.S. government. In other words, the Flores twins were going to flip. So Sheikh Shaft and a few of his colleagues traveled down to Mexico to debrief the twins and see if they were serious about actually coming over to the other side in the drug war. And this wasn't as simple as it sounds. The Sinaloa cartel is famous for having corrupted parts of the Mexican government. It's part of the reason Chapo Guzman, the head of the cartel, managed to stay at large for so many years. So when Sheikh Shaft and his team went down to Mexico to meet their potential informants, they had to do it in secret. They couldn't tip off the cartel that they were down there meeting with these guys, but they also couldn't tip off the government.
That was one of the more James Bondian experiences I've ever had, because I got picked up in an armor-plated Jeep at the airport and driven to a hotel. And then the next day we went to the U.S. consulate and then got driven around the streets of Monterey at about 110 miles an hour to make sure that nobody was following us and nobody knew where we were going. And we ended up going into the basement of a Western hotel in Monterey and taken up to a secure floor in that hotel with a lot of agents and other U.S. government personnel who had been there to make sure that it was a safe place to meet.
And this kind of cloak and dagger stuff might be normal for a DEA agent, but Sheikh Shaft was just a lawyer.
Well, when I started in the U.S. Attorney's Office, I was still single. And this case all came along sort of just after I'd gotten married and just after I'd had my first kid. And the stakes go up when all of a sudden it's not just you. There are other people relying on
you. Sure.
And I wrote a letter to my wife, and it was sort of explaining two things. One was the usual things you would say about, you know, that you love her and that kind of thing. The second, though, was trying to explain why I went. Because I had started this, I felt like it was my responsibility to go. And that, number two, that if I sort of chickened out of going at that stage, she wouldn't want to be with me anyway, because I'd be pretty miserable for having blinked in the eye of being personally nervous or scared about doing my job.
Sheikh Shaft and his colleagues were gathered in the hotel room when Pedro Flores walked in without his brother. He would be negotiating for both of them.
They were largely inseparable, in the sense of they had been in this together from the outset. And it is my belief that if only one of them had wanted to cooperate, neither of them would have.
Peter was slight, soft-spoken, a guy who would blend easily into a crowd. But as he started talking about the brothers' operation, Sheikh Shaft was stunned.
His initial description of the structure of his organization, and by his organization, their organization, and the volume of drugs that they were distributing on a monthly basis was jaw-dropping.
The brothers agreed to help Sheikh Shaft and his colleagues in exchange for lenient treatment when it came to their own crimes. So while they were still in Mexico, what they did is they started making phone calls, negotiating deals with the cartel, and recording them. And because of their position in the cartel as these major figures, these wholesale buyers, there was no one they couldn't get to. On November 15th, 2008, Pedro placed a call to Chapo Guzman himself. You got to understand, at that time, Chapo was the most wanted drug trafficker on the planet. There were no recent photos of him. People couldn't say for sure what he looked like. He was a rumor, a ghost. But Pedro just dialed him up. Suddenly, here was his voice saying, "Amigo, how's your brother?"
No soy ningún traficante, decía el Chapo Guzman.
I would say that once they decided to cooperate, they became as good a cooperators as they had been drug traffickers when they were on the other side.
Remember, the Flores brothers were supposed to be the biggest drug wholesalers in Chicago. So in order to keep up appearances, they had to continue importing drugs. And as the drugs arrived in Chicago, the feds would just happen to do a raid and seize them, which put the twins in a dicey situation.
And if you're seizing them, no money's coming back, right? There are no customers.
So you're taking the consignment, and they have no way to...
To pay for it. And that's one of the reasons that this couldn't go on longer. I mean, when we...
Because they're going into debt.
Right. And to people who expect to get paid.
To put it mildly.
Yes. On time.
Now, hold on a second, Patrick. This is very complicated. The cartels are at war, and... Each one of them is demanding that the twins choose sides, right? So the brothers decide to keep doing business with both cartels and running the risk of alienating either one while tipping off the U.S. government and recording phone calls with extremely dangerous men, right? So what made them so gutsy?
Well, it's interesting. Tom Sheikh Shaft said that it was partially guts, but it was also that they were very calculating.
They're... were some practical reasons that they did all of that. One is that they are smart guys, and they knew that if the government was to prosecute these folks, corroboration is the name of the game for a trial lawyer. And among the best corroboration that we can have when we try a case is real-time intercepted phone calls and conversations with the defendants as they are currently engaged in their drug trafficking activity.
For you guys who are working this from the government side, there must have been a conversation where on the one hand you're thinking, boy, this is such great stuff, and on the other hand you're thinking, we'd better pull them out if we ever want them to be alive long enough to testify. Was that a negotiation or—
That was my concern all along, and because if they didn't survive and didn't make it back to the United States, you've got no case against anybody. Those conversations, those recorded conversations, become much more difficult to authenticate at trial. You don't have live bodies to tell you the story. So there's a tension there between wanting to leave them in place as long as you can while you're continuing to get this good stuff, while at the same time constantly being cognizant of the danger involved and knowing that at the drop of a hat, you may need to say, let's go. It's time to get them out.
That happened on November 30th, 2008, less than a month after Sheikh Shaft and the DEA started working with them.
It was a Sunday. A big shipment, a big payment was due to the Sinaloa cartel that day or the next day, on the order of somewhere between $4 and $6 million. I also learned that DEA was planning on perhaps searching and or seizing some warehouses in Los Angeles. I became concerned that if, on the same day, the cartel didn't get paid and they had one or more of their warehouses raided, it raised the specter that the Flores brothers, rightly or wrongly, could get blamed for it.
So you realize this is going to happen. This is going to go down the next day. So was there? So there must have been great urgency in terms of.
We got them on the phone, DA and I, and we told them, "Pack your stuff. We're getting you out of there in 2 hours."
Jeez, what happened once they got back to the United States?
So once the twins got back to Chicago, Shake Shack knew that word would spread pretty quickly that they had betrayed the cartel. But they still had time to catch some of the buyers in the United States. So the brothers start doing the same thing, making phone calls. But this time, they're calling a bunch of their customers to arrange deliveries and sting operations. If you're imagining guys with guns pulling up in bleak industrial zones, that's not usually how it works. In the real world, a surprising number of drug deals happen at mundane places, like McDonald's or the parking lot of a mini mall.
You do this job long enough and you realize how much drug trafficking takes place in front of all of us all the time. I mean, I've had, you know, it's funny, I'll drive by a mall where I am familiar with the picture of the Best Buy because I prosecuted somebody who routinely, you know, it doesn't take much to deliver, say, 10 kilos of cocaine. It's a duffel bag. It moves from one trunk to another.
Eventually, word does get out that the brothers have flipped. And when it did, the threat of vengeance from the cartel, from all the people that they had betrayed, was so real that it got to the point where even their lawyers, so not the brothers themselves, but the lawyers for the Flores twins, requested anonymity, asking that their names appear nowhere in any of the public records associated with their case. All the Flores brothers' relatives had been told to stay in the U.S., where they could be protected by U.S. authorities and really never to go back to Mexico. But their father, interestingly, Margarito Sr., the guy who taught them the drug trade when they were growing up, he reportedly was really upset when he heard that they had turned on the cartel. He was really disgusted and didn't speak with them again. And eventually, he did go back to Mexico. It appears he may have had another family there, and he went down to visit them.
While he was there, he was abducted. A note was left on his car that conveyed that his abduction was related to the brothers' cooperation.
The note said, "Shut up, or we'll send you his head."
It was a little bit of like your worst anxieties coming true, in the sense that they could get to somebody.
The twins' father's body was never found, and he's never been heard from since. Shakeshaft had no idea how the brothers would react.
That was morning. I just walked in and I said to them, and I mean, I said, you know, I'm the prosecutor and you guys are the witnesses, but when something like this happens, we're all human, and today you can do whatever you want to do. I said, if you want to talk about him, you can. I said, the only thing I can't let you do is just talk, the two of you. Somebody has to be here. You know, an agent has to be here monitoring you. They were visibly distraught at both what evidently had happened to their dad and the fact that they had played a role in that happening.
Did it discourage them from cooperating?
It certainly did not discourage them from continuing to do what they were doing. And in fact, that same day, we continued to work. So
was that their decision?
Yes.
So at a certain point, they said, let's get back to work.
Yeah.
And even as they were cooperating with Shake Shack, out on the streets, the Flores brothers were being replaced in the drug-dealing chain of command.
I think it stands to reason. Common sense tells you there are still drugs available in the city of Chicago. I'm not so naive as to think that it maybe even made much of a dent in the overall war on drugs. I think we played a role. I think it was a good case. In 2008, you know, probably the wholesale value of a kilo of cocaine was about somewhere between $20,000 and $25,000. It went up after the Flores brothers were arrested. Today it's 35.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Because it actually made it harder to, it was a scarcer commodity just by virtue of taking them off the street.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a lot of factors behind it. I don't know that it was just them, but they certainly played a role.
Patrick, I've got to tell you, I'm listening to this and it's exciting. And of course we want the feds to succeed and put the dealers in jail. But doesn't this all sound like a game of whack-a-mole?
It does. It really does. And it's funny, you know, the big role that the Flores brothers looked like they were maybe going to play was as star witnesses in the trial of Chapo Guzman. But after he was arrested in 2014, Mexican authorities refused to extradite him to the U.S. They insisted he should really stay in Mexico and face trial there first. The Mexican attorney general actually said, oh, we'll be happy to turn him over to the U.S. maybe in 300 or 400 years. It looks this time like after the escape last time, the Mexican government might be a little bit more inclined to turn him over to the United States.
What's going to happen to the Flores brothers now?
Well, it depends. If the Mexican government actually does turn him over and he gets extradited here, and that could happen anytime, you know, in the next few months. It could be 6 months. It could be a year. It'll depend a little bit on where he goes. He's indicted in different jurisdictions across the country because his drug network was so vast that there are indictments against him in Brooklyn, in San Diego. And if he goes to Chicago, it seems fairly likely that the Flores twins could end up actually taking the stand and testifying against Chapo Guzman. Regardless, at this point, they're about halfway through this 14-year prison sentence that they're serving. And it looks like when they get released, they'll be placed in witness relocation. Now, Tom Shakeshaft, interestingly, thinks that if they do get put in witness protection, that the twins could survive as long as they follow the guidelines of federal witness relocation. And one of those guidelines holds that they have to be separated. They have to be in different places. They can't be in the same city. They can't be in the same state. And it seems pretty unlikely that they'll actually honor that. They are, after all, inseparable. The thing that once made them so successful may eventually cost them their lives.
Wow. Thank you, Patrick. Patrick Radden-Keefe is a staff writer at The New Yorker. We heard from Tom Shakeshaft, a former federal prosecutor now in private practice in Chicago. The Mexican government has actually agreed to extradite El Chapo, although it's still being appealed. And Pedro and Margarito Flores are still serving out their sentences somewhere in the prison system under new names.